Good evening. James McCanney here with My Science Hour, December 26, 2013, the day after Christmas. And we are at the home stretch of 2013. I cannot believe it. Just a little bit of time here until we cross into the next year. And I certainly hope next year, 2014, holds a bit brighter future for all of us. More than 2013, which I think for most people was an economic and otherwise devastating year. So at any rate, hope for that. But tonight's main science topic, I'm going to be covering the solar system formation and primarily scientific information. I'm just appalled at the kind of ridiculous fairy tale science that's being pawned off on the public. I just saw a recent article suggesting that billions of years ago, something hit Earth, caused our moon to form, and therefore, I don't know, some other results, and then that magically at the same time, life came from Mars, landed on Earth, and we all lived happily ever after. And this actually got published in a peer-reviewed journal. So which just tells me that whatever, it's just fairy tale science. But at any rate, that's what's being pawned off on you. What I want to do is concentrate on the real activity of the solar system. And last week got away from me a little bit. I had hoped to put a bit more science into last week's show, but I did want to concentrate also on the issue of what has been given to us. And I usually try and do that when I talk about a topic. I first try and tell the what has been handed to us as the real story and dispel that and then move on to what the real story is. Just a quick couple of side notes here. I noticed that not as much emphasis, but still in all of the major sites this year, they have been trying to push this idea that the Christmas star was a planetary alignment. And this year they happened to be saying it was Jupiter and Venus. And 2,000 years ago, well, as far as most scholars are concerned, I'm not sure if anybody really knows when the exact date of the birth of Christ was. And planetary alignments only last a couple hours. So to try and pinpoint it down to an alignment with Jupiter and Venus is rather absurd, rather beyond absurd. So that's one reason, only one reason, why the planetary alignment concept could not be possibly true. And so what I had done is I put on the top of my homepage a posting, and for those who have not gotten to the homepage, I'll quickly read it here. But obviously, the Christmas star was a comet, a very unusual comet. A comet that had such unusual characteristics that it, people waited thousands of years, the people who had the information on what to look for, waiting for the Messiah, they literally waited thousands of years, and so they knew exactly what they would be looking for, the three wise men, etc. So without further ado, I'm going to quickly read the posting, and this actually is a very nice lead-in to the topic of solar system formation. In fact, the existence of the Christmas star as a comet is a very essential part of solar system formation. At the top of my homepage, excuse me, it says, "A brief Christmas message," and I'm reading from the homepage now, from my homepage. "Long ago, on a starry night in three faraway lands, three wise men witnessed a comet that had been predicted thousands of years earlier. It had such unusual characteristics that they knew this was their sign to follow. The comet and a characteristic set of companion comets, unmistakable. Discovered originally in the east, the comet crossed behind the sun to lie in the western sky. For months they journeyed until it brought their three paths together in a humble animal feeding shelter in the remote town of Bethlehem near Jerusalem. The couple in the animal shelter had just discovered a baby. The bright comet overhead lit the three royal visitors' final approach to see a baby wrapped in rags. as they were descendants of the Israelite house of David, the unsuspecting parents were there to complete the census required by Roman law. When this baby was grown and in his final days of preaching to the public, he was asked to foretell where the world was going. He spoke in symbols that represented the effects of the passage near Earth of a great comet, the kind witnessed many times in the old texts. He told those listening to pass this information down to future generations. Included in his speech was the warning that in those times misinformation specialists would be sent to lead you astray. The people asked, as a common average people, how would they know to discern the truth, or how would they be able to discern the truth? The gentleman who was about to be hauled off and crucified replied, "You will know the truth, for it is written in your heart. Merry Christmas, Jim McCanny." Okay, and so that little phrase at the end is very important, because there's nothing more confusing than the information that's being passed off on the public today. So how will you know the truth? It's simply that you will know it when you hear it. It's written in your heart. So that's a very interesting phrase. And by the way, the idea of a comet initiating this whole process of a Messiah is very interesting, and a very unusual comet that has companions. What would make a comet so unusual that it would be distinctive from the hundreds and thousands of other comets that would have passed through the solar system throughout the ages? Well, obviously it is a companion. And so, just an aside note, there's a tremendous effort to try and tell people that the Christmas star was a planetary alignment. Anything but the truth. Trying to dissuade you from thinking about comets. And so it's at Christmas time that I decided to talk about the physics of solar system formation, how you should be living in response to this. And it's a very wonderful story to lead in with the Christmas star, because comets are the formative bodies that eventually become captured. They work their way into the solar system and become permanent members. Some of them little, some of them medium-sized, and some of them big. And so, as I describe in my books, the initial solar system was only two objects, the Sun and Jupiter. And so all of the other objects eventually became captured at a later date. And this is due to solar system dynamics. If you have a many-bodied system that starts out at random, which is basically the conditions in the initial solar system, then, and by the way, this is not due to a collapsing gas cloud out in the middle of nowhere. I'm not going to go into that initial portion on this show. But basically, these star systems are shot out of the region near the galactic nucleus. This is one of my peer-reviewed published papers talking about the formation of galactic arms and how the star systems are condensed matter, and then they, as a fluid flow problem, they come shooting out of the two sides of the galaxy in the form of arms and form the spiral arms. Okay, so at any rate, the original star system that we had was the Sun and Jupiter. And probably in those days, Jupiter was a lit star. It has since cooled down. It still has a minor fusion up in its upper atmosphere, as well as does Saturn, because they have a very interesting composition. The same Jupiter has the same hydrogen, helium, and etc. composition as the Sun. A very interesting fact that would tell you that they formed in the exact same environment. And why could you not have more members of the solar system at the same time? Well, basically, because of the instability of orbits. Any object that was not of the two larger original members would be tossed out of the solar system. So solar system formation, this is part of my original work In fact, the original, absolutely original papers talked about the formation of solar system. They didn't even concentrate on the topic of comets. The comet portion was very important, but it did not, the original work of my work was concentrating on solar system formation and how comets would come in, become captured, and then become permanent members of the solar system. Let's just take a recent example. Comet Ison came in as a comet that was from a distance and had basically an infinite orbit. In other words, it would have come in and then swung around the sun and then left the solar system forever, never to come back. But lo and behold, as it was worked on by the tail drag of the comet over the period of time since September, or since it began its journey into the solar system as a comet, it was announced on September 21st, 2012. But that entire time, the tail dragging onto the comet nucleus slowed it down to the point where it had a 622-year orbital period when it came around the sun and then disintegrated. And actually, the nucleus made it around the sun, but then disintegrated somewhat afterwards, probably turning into a pile of dust that continued on somewhat in the orbit, much of it blown away in the solar wind. But at any rate, the point is that the orbit of Comet Ison was reduced, and we've seen this over and over again. Comet Hale-Bopp, for example, came in with a 4,600-year period, and was it was around 4,250 years, I believe, 4,250-year orbit, and it was reduced to about a 2,600-year orbit by the time it left the solar system. All of this due to tail drag. And so, what's happening? That nucleus is dropping in closer and closer to the sun. The other effect is that its orbit is circularized over time. So this tail drag process has two effects. One is that it reduces the orbital period. And remember, we're talking in terms of Earth years. So Hale-Bopp had its orbital period reduced in half in just one orbit. That would mean if this process continued in around 2,600 years, Hale-Bopp will be back, and then its orbit might be reduced to 1,300 years, then 600 years, then 300 years, then 150 years, then 75 years, just around the point of Halley's Comet. 71 years, I believe, is the orbital period of Halley's Comet. So could Halley's Comet have gone through this same process? Well, certainly. Although Hale-Bopp seems to have lost much more than the average comet. And astronomers are going to try and tell you that that was due to an interaction, a gravitational interaction with Jupiter, but that's simply not the case. We saw daily how the ephemeris, that's the data describing the orbit of Hale-Bopp, how it changed on a daily basis over the period of years. And so just another little fun fact about my plasma discharge comet model is that it shows how cometary objects are first captured by gravitational effects of the planets that already exist. They then lose more energy because of the tail drag and eventually can drop into stable orbits in the solar system. So we have thousands and thousands of objects in the solar system which have been captured. The captured process requires two celestial bodies, typically the Sun and, say, Earth, the Sun and Jupiter, the Sun and Saturn. Every one of the major planets has cometary systems associated with it. Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune all have families of comets associated with them. These are comets that have been captured and they're now slowly working their way into the solar system. Saturn, for example, has, they say, 26 moons that are in retrograde or non-prograde orbits. In other words, they're orbits that could not possibly have been created with the so-called creation of the solar system 4.5 billion years ago, and that's a big misnomer. I looked at a definition. I was cruising around the internet this past week and saw the term pseudoscience, where they were criticizing various scientists or various thinkers, and someone trying to be derogatory led internet rage against me by claiming I was a pseudoscientist. Well, first of all, a pseudoscientist is a person that has no training and tries to be a scientist, and yes, there are people out there like that, that pretend to be scientists, and they pretend to talk science, but they're really not, and they do a lot of damage to the concepts that are being other real scientists are trying to promote. But I have an extensive background. I have a good background in physics. I've worked in other industries, not just space science. I've worked teaching physics, teaching mathematics, computer science. I have a long and very fruitful history in the computer industry, working as both a hardware and software engineer, which is totally separate from my comet work. The work on calculating primes and other entities, other mathematical problems that I've solved. So my record is very clear that I have a very solid science background, and I use that. I've also been in some places where a lot of my critics will never ever see, like Cornell University. I happened to be there for 2 years, in the physics department for a while, and then in the math department for a year and a half. And I guarantee you, none of my detractors have ever been, nor will they ever get a job at Cornell. So I always like to see these people trying to badmouth me. But the point is that they were. I then looked up the definition of what they consider pseudoscience. And one definition of pseudoscience was something that could not be proved, and that is something that I find in standard science all the time. For example, say this case where someone recently claimed that the Earth was hit. This is a published paper. It got published in the peer-reviewed journals. They claimed that Earth was hit by a big planet-sized object billions of years ago, which launched the moon out in orbit around the Earth, and that eventually life came to Earth by bacteria from Mars. And talk about a stretch of the imagination. Well, that's all fine and good, and people can sit in their ivory towers and twiddle their pencils and make up stories, but to have it published, now talk about pseudoscience. This is something that cannot be verified. Nobody was there. Maybe it was true, but the chances are that it probably isn't true and has nothing to do with what really happened. The point is, it's non-provable theorization. I wouldn't even call it science. I'd call it fairy tale science, you know, like making up a Mother Goose nursery rhyme. But the scientists, today astronomers, can make up their own pseudoscientific baloney, publish it, and it becomes standard fare. Anybody else that does that is a pseudoscientist. But anyway, the whole point of pseudoscientist is that it's science that cannot be proven. Let's look at what the Dirty Snowball Comet model proposed by NASA and standard science. They say that comets come from a place called the Oort cloud. Well, boys and girls, the Oort cloud supposedly is a couple light years away. It's supposedly this collecting ground of icy comets, very distant from the sun, and supposedly, according to their story, a big object comes by every now and then, kicks out some of these comets into our direction, and that's why comets come into the solar system. That's the story. But talk about fairy tale science, Mother Goose. You can't prove it. You can't disprove it. Well, and it'll never be detected. It's something that cannot possibly be detected. How would you get an instrument out a half a light year from Earth? We've just barely been able to get a spacecraft beyond the orbit of Pluto. So don't ever expect in your lifetime or anybody's lifetime that you know to have a spacecraft going out to where the supposed Oort cloud is. So it's an unprovable concept. That's the definition of pseudoscience. So the Oort cloud is literally pseudoscience, but it's one of the standard core taught elements in all of basic astronomy. Isn't that special? So the astronomers can make up their pseudoscience all they want, but don't let anybody else make anything up. But at any rate, the reality is there is a tremendous amount of garbage out there. I saw a note this week, and this is very disheartening, that the YouTube and Netflix are the most consulted things on the internet. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, anybody can post whatever they want on YouTube, and that's the source of information people getting. In terms of science, especially in terms of space science, YouTube is just a collection pit of pure garbage. I just want to make you aware, too, that I never post on YouTube. There are hundreds of YouTube videos that have my name, have a picture of me, have some cartoon playing while you hear allegedly my voice. I don't post anything on YouTube. I never have, never will. And so the disinformation crew is very busy using YouTube to try and destroy my name and work, making all kinds of ridiculous claims that supposedly I have said. They now have the ability to create my voice and make YouTube videos. So at any rate, that's why in the very beginning I knew that the day would come when they would do that, when they would try and destroy my work by presentation of my voice, of my work. So I never posted. I don't have email groups, etc. But what is posted on YouTube as far as so-called science is just pure garbage. NASA posts on YouTube. They have a bunch of fairy tale science professionally produced videos that just... it's just fairy tale science. That's all I can say. Not worthy of a third grade science project. But it's really a shame that people are not more discerning and are that easily fooled, that information that's coming to you is just absurd. And the people read it and listen to it. I don't know how many times a week I receive emails from people saying, is Planet X really on the other side of the sun? Or are we all going to die next week because some guy on the YouTube video said it? And I just like, you know, you poor people, just don't even go to YouTube. Just stay away from there. But at any rate, back to the formation of solar systems, the idea that a comet would come in, become captured, slowly become a planetary or minor planet or small asteroidal type object in the solar system. Then my theoretical work also says that as the orbit becomes circularized, it loses its charge and eventually becomes a permanent member of the solar system. But what happens if the orbit is backwards? What if it moves backwards in its orbit? And the answer is that chances are it will be tossed out of the solar system. It's going to be coming by at high speed. Its orbit is going to be deflected and repeatedly, and eventually it's going to encounter one of the bigger planets, and it's going to get tossed out of the solar system. Or possibly its orbit could be changed to incorporated into the solar system. The major planets all move in one direction, and there's a reason for that. There's a reason for that. If something was trying to move counterclockwise, and there are many thousands of objects out there that are doing that, their lifetime is relatively short. It's relatively short-lived that they would be in the solar system. Okay, so one of the main points from all of this, however, is this: let's come back down to Earth, where we live. All of our weather is created, sustained, and maintained by the solar electric field. This idea that light comes into our atmosphere somehow creates storm systems, and those storm systems move around and interact with each other, causing tornadoes or hurricanes or sprites above the cloud systems. Those concepts are absolutely absurd. How do you create a hurricane from a warm pool of water? You can have all the warm pools of water you want, and you will never, ever in a million gazillion years create a hurricane from warm water. How do you get the energy from a warm pool of water into this rotating, fantastically powerful storm system? And once the storm system starts moving, how do you keep pumping more energy into it from this warm pool of water? I mean, boys and girls, we're talking about PhD departments of thermodynamics at MIT that are propounding these absurd concepts. So the real story is that the hurricanes, the storm systems, the cyclones, the tornadoes, and by the way, I've got a really great picture of four water spouts. A listener sent this photo in. And there's four water spouts on the leading edge of a thunderstorm marching across one of the oceans of the world. So I have that posted on my webpage. Beautiful picture. But do you think that this is due to storm system clouds just kind of at random rubbing against each other? No, this is an organized powerful electrical circuit. And these are the plasma results of that, the movement of that circuit. And so our weather, the point is that our weather is driven by very powerful electric forces from above. But there's a little problem. If my work, my weather work, were to become well known, then wouldn't it make sense that we could be grabbing this energy instead of letting it run into big powerful storm systems that destroy everything? Wouldn't it make more sense if we did a controlled release of this energy and we ran our planet on it? Well, that's what a guy named Nikola Tesla was doing. There isn't a misinformation webpage on the internet today that doesn't slam Tesla. Why? Because he had the solution. He had the solution that would relieve us of dependence on oil, nuclear power, and coal. And so you could get into your automobile and just like a golf cart, just push on the pedal and go. You know, release the emergency brake, push on the pedal, and you're off and running. Electrically charged batteries producing the energy and storing the energy. Here's another concept that in many third world countries, they depend on water storage because they don't always have flowing water. Now, in the United States, you're very used to having pressurized water. If you live in the country, you might have a well. But the vast, vast majority of people live on city water that's pumped, it's pressurized, and it comes to your house under pressure. So the whole idea is that people have become dependent on water being there. You open the faucet, you go to take a shower, you turn the faucet on, there's the water. But in many parts of the world, that is not necessarily the case. So they have large storage containers at every house. They could be cement, they could be plastic, or some other sturdy material. But the point is, that why not, and this is very possible, it's very doable, have batteries of that size, big tanks, now and have them like the lead acid batteries imagine a battery that was, oh, let's say the size of your hot water heater. Now you're used to the battery in your car. Everybody has a good idea of the size of a battery in your car. They make industrial models of the same type of battery. They're called deep cycle batteries, and you can discharge them down to a very low percentage of charge, and they will charge up again. And of course, there's many more modern types of batteries, but the lead acid battery is the oldest and most economical to build. But imagine in your house, if you had a lead acid battery the size of your washing machine, let's say, or the washing machine and dryer, you had two of these batteries. Now, the batteries that you have in your car, or deep cycle batteries that you might have in an alternative energy system, these contain a lot of power. And so it's a very efficient way to store energy. And just like the water systems in third world countries, when the water is flowing, you fill up your tank. And when the water's not flowing, you still have water. You put a reserve right in every house. And so that could be the same way dealing with electricity. We could be storing up electricity in your electric car is another place to store electricity. You could literally plug your car and reverse the batteries by plugging your car into your house. Say you were in a case of an emergency, you could actually run your house for a few minutes or make a phone call using your automobile that runs on electricity. So, but the point is that the energy stored in your car is another form of stored energy. It's another category of storage of energy. So every house very easily could have big batteries. I'm talking big batteries, part of the construction. And of course, this should have been done from the very earliest days of electricity, where the electricity would come through a Tesla tower. It would come and be distributed out to your house by a network of wires, just like the distribution system we see today. Excuse me. And once that energy got to the house, it would be stored. So you can understand, this is just a small example of the utility of my work, that you now understand how energy can be drawn off of the environment. And where does this energy come from? Ultimately, it comes directly from the solar capacitor. So it's powered by the electrical conditions in the sun. And the key to understanding this is understanding that comets are not dirty snowballs. They're an electrical discharge of the solar capacitor. The part we see on the comet, it's just the visible part. It's just one of a thousand different types of factors of observables in a comet. But that's why it's humorous to see, it's humorous but not humorous, to see a page like spaceweather.com or all of the other apologist websites, the Naval Research Observatory web page on comets, or other so-called volunteer web pages regarding comets or standard science, that they only talk about the tail of the comet. And there are hundreds of other aspects. There's ultraviolet light, there's X-rays, there's electrical currents, there's magnetic fields, there's spectral analysis, which holds a lot of information about comets. But none of this is distributed to the public. They just talk about, oh, this nice little, look at that nice white tail. That's all they talk about. And of course, the reason is because they are trying desperately, and they're part of a conglomerate of misinformation, besides just trying to hold on to their holy grail. But basically, if the public found out that I was completely right on this, they would demand that we stop burning oil and coal and nuclear power, and start deriving the energy we need from the ionosphere, which has a huge amount of electrical power, which is being supplied every day from our solar environment. So let's take a look at exactly what we need to live. Okay, we need a roof over our heads. One thing that I started understanding a long time ago is building houses out of wood was a big mistake. Wood is a terminal material. It's going to eventually have to be replaced, and it's much cheaper and stronger to build a house out of stone or rock or cement. The modular pieces of cement go together, and now they're building homes that are extremely efficient using styrofoam and cement. And here's how they work. You make a styrofoam frame, literally a frame. You come along with the cement truck with the rebar in the placed inside of the foam frame, and you simply pour it full of cement. And it doesn't have to be solid cement. You can put tubes in there, which then allow it to be hollow. It actually makes it a better insulator. But it doesn't take all of that much cement. But you end up with an extremely sturdy house, insulated, all in one pass. You can put the electricity, the tubes, the plumbing, everything in. So when the cement truck comes along to pour the cement, it simply is, that's the final step. Then you paint it, you put the roof on, and it's all done. In fact, the roof can be made by a similar process. Come in with the same type of technology with a crane, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, boom, 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 and the roof is on, and you don't even need shingles. One of the problems with modern construction, modern wood construction, is all the different complexities. First the frame, then insulation, then you have to cover it on the inside with plastic. Now you put the sheetrock, now you put the sheetrock finishing. Okay, now you got to paint it or cover it, and it's an extremely complex process. In fact, I built a house back in the 90s. This was a modern house, and there were 51 subcontractors on the project. 51 subcontractors all had to sign off when the house was completed. You know, compare that to the pioneer who had his axe and a bunch of buddies coming over. The women cooked food. They chopped down the trees, built the cabin, and about 3 days later was ready to move in. Or they built a barn or whatever, and they'd have a big party and the people would get together. Compare that to what is going on today. And then the guy owned his house. The house was his. He didn't pay taxes. He didn't pay real estate tax. There was no guy coming out to tell him that he didn't put this beam in right or that, whatever. He had to depend on his local environment to live. And that was the end of the story. Life has gotten far too complicated. And many people think that that's the way it has to be. It really doesn't. And a long, long time ago, especially in the northern climates, and this is becoming obvious, I believe, I hope so, that people that live in the northern climates, where it's cold and you just had a tremendous ice storm move through, that building houses above ground does not make a lot of sense. You're paying for heat every day, all of the energy that's being poured into these houses, just to heat them, and all that energy is going away, up into the atmosphere, up, up, and away, and not leaving any energy for future generations. Yes, we need oil for certain items, natural gas, possibly coal, and I really don't think we need nuclear energy at all. Just ask somebody in Germany. They shut down all of their nuclear energy. And, of course, you're always going to want some form of oil, et cetera. But basically, we should be able to run our entire society off of energy. The other problem is that people are running back and forth to work, working two jobs, two people in the household working two jobs each to make ends meet, trying to keep the loan payments going. But everything they're making goes to interest. They're trying to buy a car on interest on the loan. All of that money is basically thrown out the window, because they think that they have to get a loan. It's because of the structure of housing, the way they're built, etc. And the whole issue comes down to the concept that society has gotten way out of hand with complexity. Then you need insurance. You need life insurance, you need health insurance, you need car insurance, you need umbrella insurance, you need insurance, 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 and people are just being insured to death. I always thought, why do I have to have 27 insurance policies? I'm just one person. Is my house going to burn down, my car is going to get wrecked, and all my possessions stolen on the same day? Well, probably not. So why do you have to have an individual insurance policy for everything? I'm just one person. So it's rather strange the way they structure insurance to make you pay the maximum amount. And then when it comes to put in a claim, they don't pay you. But you're required to have it. Now health insurance, government enforced. At any rate, you can see where this is going. If people lived according to the basic rules of the universe, our energy, once we set up the collection devices for energy, your energy would be free. You would be getting a small maintenance bill in the mail. And now, let me tell you something, and this is to Americans, this is to people in Europe, what we call the advanced civilizations. There are places in the world where people are happy, they don't have taxes, they don't pay insurance, they own their own home, they live there, they have the food they need because the food comes from within 5 miles of their house, the vegetables, the fruit are fresh every day, and they have a lot of time to spend with their family. They work, but they don't overwork. They're not slaves to their jobs and everything else that goes with it. And they're happy. What an amazing concept. There are actually places like this in the world. And I'm not going to tell you where they are because a lot of people would want to go there and take all of their problems and grief and bad practices with them. These are places where there's no theft. People don't lock their doors. People go walk by and everybody knows everybody and they're very friendly. They can stop and chat. How many places in the United States do people actually stop and talk to each other or even know each other? No, the United States has gotten way, way out of control, way out of hand. And the other countries that try and duplicate the Western style of life, thinking that that's the golden land, the way to live. No, I'm sorry, folks, it's not. Because ultimately it comes down to the happiness of the individual. And I don't see the people in the United States as being very happy. In fact, I see them as being very unhappy. So this is what I'm saying. If you understand that, first of all, water. Let's talk about water. The price of water is skyrocketing. There's a shortage across. On last week's show, I talked about the shortage of water. 11 major cities are literally running out of water. It's not that they are going to have rationed water. They're simply out of water. No more. You turn on the faucet and nothing is going to come out. Not today, not tomorrow, or not next week, and not next month. They are running out of water. This is an extreme situation. And to start, say, pumping water from a lake like Lake Superior or Lake Michigan to other parts of the country is not the solution either, because they'll run those dry in a short amount of time. What the problem is we have a water management problem. Every year we have spring rains. That water could be easily diverted to various parts of the country where it's held in reserve. And this could be done as part of the spring runoff this year. With the way the snow and the weather is going in the northern climate, we're going to have plenty of winter snow runoff. And what does it do? It just runs down the river out into the ocean, taking a big streamer of sediment with it. Much of the good farmland has, after the cutting the trees down, all that land from Indiana, the frill started in New Jersey, all of the eastern Massachusetts, all of that was woods. They cut the trees down, made it into farmland, then urban sprawl took over. Now the farmland is being pushed back. They have fence post to fence post farming using chemicals, and the food has no value anymore. It has no food. The biggest depleted land areas in the world are in the central United States so-called breadbasket area. We have been working against the grain, and the payback is coming. It's coming soon, and it's going to be swift, and it's not going to be funny. The water depletion, and remember that much of this is by design. By design, because the big corporations can control water, they can control the food. Third world countries today, many of them no longer have the original plant seed structure that they had even 15 or 10 years ago. The fruit that comes to you from the foreign countries with the so-called free trade agreements, the big corporations have come in without license or without even asking and simply can put hybrid food and replace it so that the people are forced to eat fruits, vegetables, etc. that are hybrid. In other words, they cannot save their seeds and grow them next year. In addition, the food is what I call Frankenstein food. Who knows what you're eating? It's really turning into a big mess. So there are small pockets in the world, and they're being exterminated. These places are intentionally being exterminated because if a big worldwide problem occurred, which would involve, say, stoppage of transportation on a large scale, these small pockets would survive and do just as well because they would continue to live exactly as they're living today. So the large corporations, the Monsantos, the Cargills, the other corporation, the Nestle Corporation, who's been taking over water rights, they're exterminating, they're routing out and exterminating native populations all over the world to make sure that you, the public, can never return and grow your own food, have your own independence of water, etc. So this is not a very happy Christmas message, but the other bright side of it is that people can, on an individual basis, go out and learn how to live within nature's, the means that nature has given us. And it's still possible, but I'm not going to tell people there's no magic map on where to go. There's no magic trail to follow. And many times you can stay almost where you are and build your own world, build your own lifestyle. I do not recommend groups or forming groups. I don't recommend any group over 10 or 15 people maximum. And most of the time it's best if it's just your family, people that you know. Don't make the mistake of inviting in a bunch of unknown people, especially they come in, oh, we're going to help you out, we're going to do all these things for you. No, you just do it on your own. Keep it simple. Keep it, in fact, don't go out and broadcast it to everybody. Just go away and start living your own life and become happy. Because a lot of people are trapped in the system and they don't know any better. They're never going to know any better. They're not going to do any better because they're going to simply be trapped. So let's go back to solar system formation. Where does water come from? That's one of the main issues that standard science cannot answer. Where did the oceans come from? They can't answer that simple question, because if the solar system formed all at one time billions of years ago, the heat of formation would have roasted off any atmosphere, it would have roasted off any water, and so at a later time you have to find out where did the water come from. And then you have enigmas like Mars. Mars obviously had water recently, and it's all gone. Where did it go? Well, it's obvious the ancients tell us clearly where it went. The water on Mars was sucked off by a passing large comet. That comet eventually became the planet Venus. That comet also had two major interactions with planet Earth. And so these ancient texts tell us exactly what's going on. I thought it comical a couple weeks ago, I reported, that now standard science is saying, oh, the Bible tells us that comets came in and did certain damage. And, of course, I've been saying this all along, Velikovsky's story about Venus the comet becoming Venus the planet and devastating Mars on its path, twice devastating Earth, that story makes complete sense. But what happens with standard science, they twist it into their fairy tale science and say, oh, a comet hit Earth, and that's what caused Noah's flood. You know, how absurd. Noah's flood was 40 days and 40 nights of torrential rain. That means we passed through a comet tail, and that comet tail had to be big. And it was from a plasma discharge comet. It also rained in oil. The naphtha, the burning naphtha, the brimstone and fire and brimstone coming from above. Where do you think that came from? Those ancient texts were correct. And so then the populace had to rebuild and come back from basically the cave ages. When we passed through the large comet tail, we lost sunlight, we lost the energy from the sun, and so what happened? The Earth went into a period of glaciation. It took thousands and thousands of years for the Earth to begin warming up, and we see the cavemen, that the few people who survived those episodes, a very tough breed of human being that survived, was able to hunt and gather and bring us back to the human population that we have today. Then also there was a pole shift, a physical pole shift, which could have only been caused by that comet coming over the North Pole and shifting our North Pole actually by about 30 degrees. There was a large population on Earth prior to that, large human habitable population. The South Pole, Antarctica, was a habitable continent with mastodons, with people, and when it shifted, it became covered with ice and snow, and that snowpack is still there and sliding off slowly because the land is still warm. The ice and snowpacks of Antarctica are actually moving, and when they actually drill down and can get to the land below it, it's still warm because that ice has insulated it for all of these years, for all these thousands, if not tens of thousands of years. So why do we have to understand how the solar system forms to then understand how to live? Well, one issue, and I talk about this in the Diamond Principle, is that we have a limited time as a civilization to get off this planet. We have a limited amount of resources, and as long as the powers that be can divert you from your real goal in life, and this is especially to the kids out there who are playing video games and other burning their lives up with distractions, you have to take control of our future. And as a scientist, as a person who spent much of my life pursuing science, I can tell you that we have squandered our space resources through an organization called NASA. We cannot squander your future generation at the hands of this same organization. It has to end, and we have to have real space development where we have space colonies. We have large groups of people going into outer space, populating space, and learning how to live there. And it's not going to happen overnight. It is not going to happen overnight. And I would estimate that probably a good 100 years of a very concentrated technological advancements it would take for us to really get our feet under us as far as living in outer space. And in that way, if there's an Earth disaster, large comet coming through the solar system, devastating Earth, only in that way do we have a guaranteed chance of surviving. So this is very important. This idea that NASA in another 20 years might send a man back to the moon, it's just absurd, absolutely absurd. And China, unfortunately, even though they have a lot of fanfare, they say they just landed on the moon. Maybe they did. I don't have any proof of it. The footage they sent back looked pretty Mickey Mouse to me. Looked like the same Hollywood stage that Apollo was staged on. But maybe they did land there. Who cares? They're not doing anything to advance science. They're not doing anything to advance creating a habitable population in outer space. In fact, I make this point in my book, The Diamond Principle, that if you truly want to go into outer space, you don't try and land or form colonies on other planetary objects like the moon or Mars, etc. You try and form space stations where you can live autonomously, because if you go to another planet or celestial object, you're dealing with the same problems you have here, except far worse, because you have the radiation, you don't have an atmosphere, you don't have any water. In a space station, a free-floating space station in outer space, you can attract water, you can attract all of the chemicals, the carbons, the hydrogens, the nitrogens, the oxygen, all of the chemicals structure that you need can be attracted to that free-floating spacecraft. So you literally can construct space stations to live on. But to do that, you have to understand the true formation of our own planet here in all of the thousands and thousands of complex interacting factors that we live with on a daily basis on Earth. The magnetic field, the temperature, the weather, the humidity, the length of the day, the length of the night compared to day, the change in temperature between night and day, the plant physiology that we've become accustomed to eating, and on and on and on. At any rate, I'm going to continue in this vein next week, going a bit deeper into the concept, the physics of solar system formation, and how to live, and then also how not to live in our environment. But I just want to end this show. This is the last show of 2013. I want to thank all of my listeners. It's been a wonderful year. It's been a very difficult year. When I released my comets book last spring, I was brutally attacked in the computer systems, the hacking, the everything else we had to deal with, all of the other tremendous amount of misinformation I've had to try and sustain attacks under that constantly. It's only getting worse. But the bright part of all of this is I have such a wonderful audience. Thank you very much. It's been a great year, and being attacked tells me one thing. That means people see that I'm successful. If I were not successful in bringing my message to you, the listeners, they wouldn't pay 2 cents, they wouldn't pay 2 seconds of attention towards me. So the fact that I'm getting all of the abuse, the tremendous amount of information, misinformation pointed at me, tells me that I'm being very successful. So, and that's partly in thanks to you, the listening audience. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.